Welcome everybody to a new episode of the Van Dijk & Van Dijk podcast. As you all know, we are a podcast about taste in all its shapes and forms, but mainly liquid. Usually it's me and Yannick, the two Van Dijks, but Yannick is not here today, it's just me. And as you have probably already noticed, this one is in English, because we have an English-speaking guest again. And usually this is the bit where I chit-chat a little bit with Yannick before I go to the first question for my guest. But since Yannick is not here, let's go straight ahead and go Alistair Walker. Who are you?
So I'm Alistair Walker, and I'm an independent bottler. I have a brand called Infrequent Flyers, which I set up in 2018. And I'm here in Belgium on a little tasting tour this week.
Yeah, we are here because you probably heard that there's some noise in the background. We are at Tastu, one of the biggest shops in Belgium, spirit shops in Belgium. And there's a tasting later on tonight, which you'll be hosting. I hear there's about 50 people joining. So
50 people, which will for me is quite a big audience.
Are you shy?
Not shy, yeah. just not very popular.
Okay. Well, I'll be one of the 50, so I'll be enjoying the drams you'll have on offer. Now, the lineup for tonight is a bit of a revisiting of some older batches.
Yes.
But you have, let's just take it from the beginning, the recent batch that you have now.
Yeah.
What kind of whiskies do you bottle?
So we're very focused on Scotch. You know, a lot of independent bottlers will broaden their horizons to whiskies from outside of Scotland, mm-hmm. and also other spirit categories like rum and Calvados, etc. My approach over the last 5 years has been very home-based. The reason for that is that the contacts I have and the people that I know and the category that I really understand more than others is Scotch whisky. So it's not to say that I wouldn't go beyond these shores, but I'd probably need to educate myself a little bit more before reaching out to some of those other categories. So Scotch whisky, predominantly single cask, single malt. Mm-hmm. We do a little bit of single grain, but it's mainly single malt. And what I suppose I say it is just me. So I don't want to try and sound bigger than I am.
It's majestic plural.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. What I look for in all batch releases is variation. You're looking for variation in terms of the distillery makes. You're looking for variation in terms of age profile, in terms of wood type, in terms of flavour profile. You just want to bring a lot of different things at the one time.
Yeah, so you're at batch 15 now?
Batch 15,
batch 15. Yeah. And so I understand that you want for each batch, you want like a sherried expression, a bourbon expression, an older, a younger, something. That's the variation.
Exactly, exactly, yeah. And to be honest, that's probably not unique to mm-hmm. Infrequent Flyers. And sometimes the sherry expression, there may be more than one. We do have a relatively high percentage of sherry casks in the inventory. The other golden rule, I suppose, and I think a lot of bottlers follow this, is that you never bottle the same distillery two bottlings in a row.
Okay.
And I've kind of been quite strict in adhering to that rule.
And is there an objective reason to that, or is it more like...
I just feel that if you've got choices within your inventory, you don't want to just be coming back with the same make time after time mm-hmm. after time, no matter how good that whiskey might be.
Okay, I can understand that. Now, I've done a little bit of research, and I know this is a question you don't like, but what is your USP? Your unique selling proposition?
Well, yeah, I really don't like that question. Again, this comes, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say that I do anything that is unique and that no other independent bottler does. What I would say is an area where I allocate a lot of time and resource is to re-racking and wood finishing. I think if you look at the releases that we've brought out over the last 5 years, you can see that we experiment with a lot of different wood types, whether it's sherry cask, port cask, wine finishes, Sauterne, rum, Madeira. It's probably something that that became ingrained in me mm-hmm. when I was working at Benriach, because yeah. Benriach was notorious for that type of behaviour.
Yeah, one of the first, I think, to really go all in on that kind of.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give Brooklandy some credit here.
Yeah,
they were doing a lot before we were doing it at Benriach, but we certainly took that on board. Wood is such a key component in shaping the profile of a whisky, and part of that, and I guess any independent bottler will probably give you this response, but part of that is to do with the fact that we're not distillers, we don't make the whisky, so the one area where we have the opportunity to influence the flavour profile is on the like a re-rack program or wood management.
Mm-hmm. And that's also a question I really like to ask independent bottlers. Is there a thread running through all the bottlings you do? Is there something unique, not a USP, because I know you don't like the name, but in the flavor, is there something that if you taste an infrequent flyers bottling that could lead you to saying, I think this is what Alistair selected?
I don't know. I don't think so, because the breadth of distilleries that we're working with in terms of casks and the various different wood types, it's too wide for there to be a commonality there. What you might, it's maybe, I'm not sure you can quantify it, but what you might pick up on is that the finishes tend to be quite long.
Okay.
And one of the reasons for that is that, it's still a small operation. I would say on average we bottle between 35 and 40 casks per year,
mm-hmm.
but we re-rack over 100.
Okay.
So the pace of the bottlings cannot keep up with the pace of the re-racks, which
yeah.
ultimately leads to a situation where the finishing periods get longer and longer and
yeah.
longer.
That's the same problem that every whiskey fan has, that they buy more bottles than they can drink.
Exactly.
Usually.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
which I think should be encouraged. Yeah.
Yes, I think so too. The re-racking is really interesting to me, because I've been thinking about this the last months, and is this would you call this idea of re-racking, is that a modern style of whiskey as opposed to old school where this just didn't happen?
Yeah, it probably is a relatively modern trend. I actually think if you go back 20, 30 years, mm-hmm. I don't think woods was given quite the same attention
mm-hmm.
as it is today. I think there's a much greater understanding mm-hmm. of the importance of wood. And historically, I think it was fairly common to press ahead with first, second fill bourbon barrels, refill hogsheads, which are perfectly good, good
which
cast.
Is now called the old school style.
Old school style.
Yeah.
Things like sherry, port, there is a tradition there, but I think distillers and bottlers have become much more experimental mm-hmm. over the last few years. Independent bottlers, perhaps more so, coming back to the point that is the one area where they're actually allowed to put their fingerprint on the liquid.
And maybe also because it's harder for a distillery to put out a new core range bottling with a distinctive...
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
Distinctive
yeah.
Re-racking or refinishing, because if it doesn't work, they're stuck with...
Stuck with it.
Yeah.
And also, independent bottlers, by and large, are usually quite small operations.
Mm-hmm.
By our nature, we're kind of fleet of foot, we're nimble, we can react to things quickly. Because we're only doing one cask at a time,
mm-hmm.
you can bring something out and it's gone. It sells,
yeah.
It's gone. it's the ability to do things quickly and on a kind of a limited basis that I suppose works in favour of us.
Maybe also what the public or the audience is expecting from independent bottlers to do more extreme, unique, special things.
Yeah, absolutely. Variety, experimentation, something different. I think that's kind of it's a key component of independent bottling. Mm-hmm.
There's a bottle on the table already.
You
selected something. Is this in the vein of what we're talking about now?
Yes, absolutely. This is I think this is from batch 15, which is our most recent bottling, which was February this year. I'll explain what it is, but I'll just pour a dram first.
I'm very curious what you selected because I haven't seen the front of the label yet.
Ah, okay. Just pouring.
Beautiful dark colour.
Yep, so I will show you now. The whiskey I've picked is it's a Dumbarton, 26-year-old. So this is a single grain. Now, we haven't bottled a huge amount of single grains. I guess maybe five or six. And our output of single grain probably reflects the number of single grain distilleries that there are. Mm-hmm. In Scotland, but I think single grains are very interesting when they get to a certain age. Mm-hmm. They've got to have maturity. This one's 26 years old, so it's got some maturity. They bring in these amazing aldehydic notes, you know, almonds, really intense marzipan, coconut, but you also do get that almost industrial sweet solventy note. And what we've done here, we've paired that with a Pedro Ximenez sherry puncheon, and it's been in there for 5 years. So you've got a really interesting combination of influences and flavour profiles going on there.
There's a lot going on in the glass, in the nose. I haven't even tasted yet, but the industrial part, the solventy part, the glue part is really there. But it's really nice.
Yeah, it's glue. Glue's actually, that's a very good word to capture some of the aromas that you get. And it's funny, I sometimes think the language that we use around grain whiskey can be off-putting, and it's not meant to be. It's a very good description, but I actually think that it's a positive, you know. And it's a little bit misunderstood. We do, in certain markets, have difficulties in selling grain whiskey.
Because single malt is king, and that's the best thing ever, and there's nothing better than single malt.
Well, that's...
I'm paraphrasing.
That's what some people would believe. I just think it's single grain is perhaps been much maligned over the years. I think part of the problem is that ultimately, it's been considered a commodity that is its entire purpose in life is to dilute blends with. Mm-hmm. So single grain or grain whiskies were never filled into the best quality wood. That's where independent bottlers can actually play a significant role, where they pick up a cask, and if they've got the time, they can transfer it into a really good cask and give it a little bit of attention and then bring it to the market. Very unusual to find a grain whiskey that spent 5 years in a PX sherry cask.
So this was first in bourbon.
This would have been a very, you know, third or fourth fill hogshead or bourbon barrel. You very rarely pick up a single grain that's in top quality wood.
Grain whiskey is actually pretty interesting to me because what you were saying, I was actually going to ask you about. This is this is bulk. It's made to be bulk.
Absolutely.
And it was never meant to be this, what's now in our glasses. And still it can happen. But how much of that is on purpose?
Very little. Yeah. I think it's very much accidental. You know, Dumbarton's an interesting one. If we take this example, it's a distillery that no longer exists. It was demolished many, many years ago. I have no idea how many casks of Dumbarton still exist to this day. It could be a lot because grain distilleries typically have massive production, but the flip side of that is that very little grain whiskey is allowed to age for a long period of time, it's predominantly used at 3 years old.
Yeah.
So my suspicions, based on the very limited number of bottlings I've seen of Dumbarton over the years, is that there's not a lot left. But I mean, the fact that we've got this and it's in a sherry cask, that was never the intended purpose for this liquid.
You started out in 2018 as an independent bottler, so that's 6 years ago.
This has
spent 5 years in cask, so this was one of the first ones you put away.
This one, unlike most of the whiskies that I bring to the market, I actually bought this and it was already in the sherry cask. Someone quite close to me did this re-rack, and I'll say no more.
Yeah. I'll let people guess, and I'll also refer to one of the earlier podcasts.
But yeah, we started in 2018, and the first re-rack program we did was 2019. And I still actually have some casks in the inventory from that re-rack. So that was April 2019. We're now at April 2024, so those casts from Rewrite 1 have been in there for 5 years. So you're getting to some really long finishing periods now.
Yeah. Grain whiskey is often about the wood it's in. And if I'm a bad person, I would say it doesn't really matter which distillery it comes from, if it's grain, because it's all the same and it's just the wood that influences it.
Is
that too harsh?
It's maybe a little bit harsh, but I understand it, because I do see a lot of similarities in the flavour profiles across the spectrum of grain whiskies. And I think that's probably one of the reasons that single malt tends to stand apart from grain. I think with single malt, the distillery is much more nuanced in terms of what it brings to the final product.
It's also probably more individual, and you can, as a customer, as a drinker, you can identify more with a single malt brand, because I'm an Ardbeg guy, I'm a Laphroaig guy, or I'm a Glendronach guy.
Yeah.
You can get real, there's a fan base.
There's a fan base, you can go and visit the place where the whiskey's produced. Very, very, very few grain distilleries will allow you to cross the doorstep to have a look around. And to be honest, you might not find it that interesting, because it's an industrial process. It's like a factory.
Yeah.
Single malt does have a lot of plus points over grain.
Okay. I was going through your releases on Whiskey Base, and I noticed there's no blended malts. If I saw correctly.
No, you're 100% right. Yeah, I try to keep things simple.
Yeah.
We use one type of bottle, we have one type of label, we just change the colour.
Yeah.
There will be a blended malt at some point. I have some whiskey in the inventory that I purchased as blended malt from a particular region of Scotland that's quite difficult to get whiskey from. And I've actually done quite an interesting re-rack on some but not all of that whiskey. It's just finding the right moment and actually coming up with a slightly modified label to bring it to the market.
That's not an infrequent flyer then?
It probably will be an infrequent flyer, but I'll need to adjust a couple of things to make it work within the rules.
Yeah. Maybe for the people that don't know the brand Infrequent Flyers, what is that all about? Why is it called Infrequent Flyers?
The name is kind of random. I have to tell you, when I started this in 2018, I didn't actually have the name for about 9 months. Every time I came up with what I thought was a great name for a whiskey, I found out that it was already trademarked.
Yeah.
So plan B was to go for a name that has nothing to do with whiskey, in which case you have a really good chance to get the trademark. And the idea with Infrequent Flyers is that a lot of the distilleries that we will bring to the market are the lesser known distilleries. They're the infrequent flyers. You know, it could be a Milton Duff, it could be a Breval, it could be a Manic Moor. Not the household names, the kind of lesser known names.
The workhorse distilleries.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. And, that's for for different reasons, I guess, for availability of casks, maybe?
Absolutely,
affordability,
yeah.
Affordability,
too? Availability, affordability. Speak to any independent bottler today, and they'll tell you the biggest challenge is getting access to stock and getting access to stock at sensible prices.
Mm-hmm.
Big challenge. The market has moved on a lot in the last 10, 15 years. Distillers do not have as much excess stock as they used to. Prices are going up. There's certain makes that you just can't get. But I do think the role of an independent bottler is to turn some attention to those lesser known malts anyway. I always say, whiskey is, there is a way to make whiskey that all distilleries follow. They'll have their differences, but they all make good product, and it's just about getting that product out to the people.
I'm trying to imagine you on a selection day. You have batch 15, which is how many bottles?
This was a small batch. We did six casks on batch 15.
How many casks have you tasted before you selected the six casks you will bottle now?
You plan these things about 12 to 18 months in advance. I'm already working towards next year's bottlings, and I suppose you look at what you've bought. I try not to be repetitive, so I'm looking at things that I maybe haven't bottled for a while. So you start looking at the inventory. It really all kicks off on a spreadsheet. You start looking at things that look good on paper, and you might, for a run of six casks, you might have a short list of 25. Then you'll get the samples in, and you'll start tasting and nosing, and then you can really nail it down to what the final selection is going to be. But it initially it's on paper, but then you have to get in and look at the liquid. Sometimes what you think it will have happened to a whiskey has not gone the way you hoped. So it's going to go back for further maturation, but you can drill it down then to the final selection.
But you get these 25 cask samples. You don't know beforehand how many you will select. Is that also like, I'm going to select six now?
I like to do six or seven. Okay. It's not too few, not too many. It's a nice selection for retailers to bring in at the one time. It doesn't overwhelm them, but it does give you a good shelf presence as well. This particular run, batch 15, would have been seven, but the last cask I wasn't completely convinced by, so I just decided to go for a smaller batch.
Yeah. The first parameter of selection is probably just quality.
Quality is number one. Then you have to start looking at variety. But it's you've got to like it yourself to put it in a bottle. But once the quality is okay, then it's okay. What age is this? What's the price point going to be? What type of wood is it? Do we have a peated whiskey in the mix? Have we bottled this one recently? Have we ever bottled this one? And suddenly there's so many factors at play, it gets a little bit complicated.
Yeah.
But eventually, out of all the chaos, you come up with the final list.
I saw on LinkedIn that you have a degree in mathematics.
Yes, unbelievable.
I don't know you that well, but I was just wondering how much of the mathematics goes on while you're selecting, and then especially on at the matter of price point.
You know, price point, for me, we sell to 10, 11 countries throughout the world. I can only look at the price points in the UK. We start looking at where things are in the UK, and we tend to work back from that. Fortunately, the UK, when it comes to Scotch, it kind of acts as a template for positioning. So that works quite well. I think the only... I do use a lot of spreadsheets. They're very useful. When in doubt, knock up a spreadsheet.
It's almost like I'm talking to Mark Watt now, because he's also always talking about spreadsheets.
they're very helpful. And I think
whiskey bottlers are all just a bunch of nerds, right?
Of course. Yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't say that you need a mathematics degree to be an independent bottler. But I think the kind of methodology in terms of working through processes and systems that suit you as to how to bring a bottle to market, how to pick cask, etc. There's probably a little bit of that going on in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, of course, you have a famous father.
Apparently. He keeps telling me he's famous.
He's some kind of famous. And I'm going to... He was in the whiskey business since 1972, about 50 years.
Yeah.
You grew up with a whiskey presence in your house.
Yeah.
How is that? Because I'm wondering, because I have two small kids now, and I also have a lot of whiskey around the house, and it's my job. So what did that do to you? Did you become interested from early on in...
No. I always say I fell into the whiskey business by accident. It was never my dream to work in the whiskey business. When I was a kid, my dad worked for Inverhouse Distillers, and Inverhouse used to have a blended whiskey called Pinwinny. I don't know if you can still get it, but Pinwinny came in a dark green bottle, but the bottle was packed into like a purple velvet drawstring pouch, and every kid in the local area used to have one of these pouches, and they kept their marbles in it. Now, some people would say I lost my marbles a long time ago, but it's you know, and geez, you're going back to a time when kids played with marbles. That was my interest in whiskey, was the fact that I had a Pinwinny drawstring bag for my marbles. The only reason I started working in the industry was when I left university, I needed to get some experience on my CV, and my dad said, look, come and work at Burn Stewart for a year and then go and do whatever. Mm-hmm. And I've never left.
You never recovered.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I hold him accountable for that every day.
Yeah. Well, there's worse things you can hold him accountable for.
Mm-hmm.
Then you ended up with Benriach, of course, for a long stretch of time until it got sold. And then you started as an independent bottler, and I saw on your website you called it a matter of a gamekeeper becoming a poacher.
Gamekeeper turned poacher,
Usually it's the other way around, and there's advantages to that, to having a poacher as a gamekeeper.
Yeah.
What are the advantages of having been a gamekeeper becoming a poacher in the whiskey business?
Well, I'm trying to think if there are any.
Yeah.
I guess I've brought... almost like a distillery mentality to independent bottling. You know, a lot of the things that we did, especially at Benriach and Glendronach, in terms of wood management, building up inventory, are things that I've brought into play. I think there's two ways to do independent bottling. The old-fashioned way is where you buy a cask, you bottle it, you generate money to buy the next cask, and you go from there. It's quite difficult in today's environment to do it like that. Mm-hmm. Cask prices are quite high, and I think you need to buy stock and sit on it for a period of time to actually make it profitable. So it's like I want to build up an inventory. I like to have choices. So when I'm bottling... or I'm going to pick a batch, I don't want to be spot buying on the market.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be looking at my inventory and saying, right, those are the casks that I'm going to bottle. I know these casks, I've had them under my stewardship for some time, and they're ready and they're available. And that to me is maybe more of a distiller's mentality than an IB mentality.
I think it is. It's also the idea of taking your time. Things.
Mm-hmm.
That's very much a distiller's thing, I think.
Definitely, yeah.
And maybe that's also quite, as you said, modern for modern bottlers.
Yeah, and I think the way the industry's going, I think independent bottlers are being forced to go down that road. Mm-hmm. But it's difficult because, you know, inventory, there's an investment there.
There's money sitting there, doing anything.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's not, I would say it's a more difficult sector to get into now than it was 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah, that's also something I was wondering about, because we are in an all-time high for whiskey at the moment. Distilleries are upscaling production. There's new distilleries popping up all over, and in the next couple of years, lots of those will be starting entering the market. There's loads of new independent bottlers too. Where do you see this going?
Oh, well, what a question.
Yeah, just cut it short.
I have to say, and I'll caveat this, because this industry changes all the time, and whatever today's environment is will be different in 5 years, but it's tough for independent bottlers just now. The industry isn't particularly, it's not a favourable environment to be an independent bottler. Stock's becoming tight, it's becoming expensive. Getting things done for a small player, whether it's bottling or samples or re-racks, is very, very challenging. And there's a lot of obstacles in the path for independent bottlers. If you were wanting to come into that now, you'd have a lot of challenges ahead of you. It's tough. I could see a situation where the IB section starts to shrink just because of these challenges. As for, you know, all the new distilleries and the increases in capacity, etc., that's going to be very interesting, because we're yet to see if the market is there when a lot of these guys are getting to 8, 9, 10, 11 year old, and they're the true versions of their whiskies are coming to the
not
market.
Just the first releases, the first batches.
First releases are always popular, you know, inaugural releases, very collectible, highly sought after, but what you need is that repeat business, and it's when you get to your 10 year old, whatever your kind of core flagship product's going to be. And this is further down the line for a lot of people. That is very hard to predict how that's going to pan out.
Yeah, because it's also dependent on just what the world is doing.
And as we've seen in the last year or two, the world, let's go back to COVID and take it from there. The world, things happen that you really don't anticipate.
In 50 years' time, we're going to be talking about these past 5 years as if it was...
Yeah, I mean, how could so many things happen in that period of time?
I have something to taste too. I'll pour it for you. I'll not tell you what it is before you taste it.
Okay, I'm looking away.
Ah, that's okay. It's actually from one of your colleague independent bottlers. Just love that sound.
That is the best sound.
Just have a sip of that, because I hope you're going to like it. This is always the quiet moment in tasting in the podcast.
Yeah,
because we're both nosing this now.
Nosing doesn't work well on audio.
No.
A lot of banana on the on the nose. Well, don't ask me to guess, because I'm not
going to
get it.
I'm not going to ask you to guess, but do you like it?
Yeah, it's very nice. What have we got here?
I read somewhere that one of the distilleries you really like is Ben Nevis.
I do. I love Ben Nevis. Yeah.
So recently, I got a bottle from Claxton's.
Okay.
Independent bottler.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, they have this Explorer series.
Yes, yes.
And they have on each Explorer series, they have a little coin on the top.
Yeah.
And if you collect 5, you can turn it in and buy a really nice bottle for
a
low amount of money.
Okay.
So this is a Ben Nevis 27-year-old.
Wow.
That I got for 95 euros.
What a bargain.
Yeah. Bottled at 43.5%. And I really just like this so much.
This might be the oldest Ben Nevis that I've actually tasted. This is excellent, yeah.
Yeah, I was just reading about this. I saw Ben Nevis popping up sometimes in interviews with you. Like,
yeah,
I like
it's
distillery, so.
Good whiskey. I like the bottlings I've tried. I've got a few casks. There's a few that I kind of go to. I still love Glendronach. I mean, the Glendronach 18... for me was the kind of, it just encapsulated everything that Glendronach was. And when I left, I purchased enough stock from the staff shop to last me for the rest of my life. it's a go-to. I think Aaron do some fantastic stuff as well. But Ben Nevis, and you know, Ben Nevis is not the easiest whiskey to get bottles of. They do very, very few official releases from the distillery.
It's more an independent, independent favourite.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I can tell you, whenever we bottle a Ben Nevis, it is not difficult to sell.
Yeah,
it's got real.
It became really popular the last couple of years.
Yeah, it's got a cult following for sure.
1996s and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You select from all kinds of distilleries from all over Scotland. Is there one still on your bucket list that you'd really like to do?
Well, there's a lot. I was really bored a couple of years back, and I took out a large A3 sheet of paper, and I wrote three lists. Whiskies I've bottled, whiskies I haven't bottled but might be able to bottle, whiskies I never have an opportunity to bottle, either because they're not available or they're just too expensive. The one to come back to my old stomping ground, I'd love to do a Glendronic. Glendronics, you very rarely see Glendronic now as an independent, and it's all Billy Walker's fault.
When he made it too popular.
Well, yeah, when we bought Glendronic, because it was Glendronic's a smaller distillery than Benriach. The capacity is about half the size. A more popular distillery.
Mm-hmm.
So the decision was made to keep all of the liquid for our own purposes at that time. So there were no sales of cask to independents. There was no fillings for other distilleries, which we did do with Benriach and with Glenglassaugh. So really, since 2008, there's been no opportunity to buy a cask of Glendronic, which means anything that is out there now is prior to that date, which is why you see very few independent bottlings, and which is why it will be almost impossible for me to get access to one. I was once offered one, but the price was beyond eye-watering.
Just the official single cask bottlings nowadays of Glendronic are really
expensive. I wish I'd bought a few more of those from the staff shop.
Me too. My Glendronic was my first real whiskey love.
Yeah, it's a great whiskey, and you know, people, it's very accessible because of the wood that they use. People love that profile. I've got nothing but love for Glendronic.
Yeah, I can understand. It's a great distillery. Everybody should go.
Indeed.
I'm just looking at my page here for some stuff I forgot to ask you. Oh yeah, also one of the reasons I got this Ben Nevis to taste to you is because of the idea of the coins and and that got me the idea. You have infrequent flyers.
Yes.
Why don't you have people collect air miles and get some kind of club going?
It's you're not the first person that suggested that. It is a good idea, but there's just so many other things to do. I get really, you know, it's funny when you set up as an independent bottler, and I've heard this from so many of my counterparts in the industry. You think your life is going to be all about the whiskey. There's so much admin and logistics to deal with. Well, that's the fun part.
Yeah.
But, you know, trying to pull together a bottling is a very complex, time-consuming. And there's so much paperwork. So trying to, you know, I would say most of my time is preoccupied with re-racks, with bottling, and with getting orders out to the market. In between that, you maybe spend 15% of your time on the actual whiskey. So things like the great idea of an infrequent flyers club never ever seems to get any time.
Yeah, I guess it's also a matter of what you like to do most, and I just get the feeling that this is stuff that you don't like to do.
Yeah, and that's the thing. If you're going to be your own boss, you should. There's no point if you fill your life up with things that don't entertain you. Mm-hmm. So you should try to limit the onerous tasks within your day-to-day life.
Yeah. Is that also why on your website it says when you started out as an independent bottler, you said you are unemployable?
Yes, absolutely.
You call yourself unemployable?
Unemployable, yeah. I probably now would find it very difficult to actually go and work for somebody. Mm-hmm. When I worked at Ben Rieck, I actually had a lot of autonomy. You know, my father was, he let us get on with it. You know, he's not a micromanager. He was very occupied with the liquids, and we looked after the sales and marketing, and we had a free rein. And I suppose...
Was that a good idea, Alistair?
Well, that's subjective. Yeah, exactly. So I would find it challenging to have to go back to kind of reporting into someone. And that's one of the reasons I set up on my own. I liked the idea of trying to build something out of nothing, and also just being completely in control of your own destiny. I've been in two companies where my future changed because of changes of ownership, where to a certain extent, don't get me wrong, I had some choices there, but there's nothing better than being the kind of master of your own destiny, mm-hmm. as much as that is possible in life. Mm-hmm.
What's the most fun part of your job?
I guess having a drink, you know, sometimes just sitting back and socialising with your industry colleagues. Mm-hmm. You know, when you get out to the market, which I actually don't do as often as I should, but when you get out to the market and you're at a whiskey festival and you get a chance to go for a couple of drinks with the people you know from other distilleries, these are excellent, excellent nights. Mm-hmm.
That's also what I always notice when you're at a festival like Spirits in the Sky, for example. I have the chance of working there and then also being there when the festival closes. Mm-hmm. Doing what you just said, just talking to people, having fun. It strikes me that this is quite unique to the whiskey world. This camaraderie, colleagueship.
I think it probably is. I mean, I don't have anything to compare it to, but I always say it's the thing that keeps bringing me back to the industry. I can't imagine there's another sector where you are so friendly with your competitors. Mm. And not only that, some of your customers become your friends, whether it's a retailer, a distributor, a consumer. Mm. But the... You know, I can pick up the phone to so many people from other distilleries and say, look, I've got a problem. What do you think about this? What do you think about that? Mm-hmm. They don't view you as the competition. Everybody, by and large, is super friendly, really helpful. And we all seem to enjoy each other's company.
I also think that if you would ask 100 people in the streets, who would you rather hang out with, a bunch of whiskey people or a bunch of mathematicians? The choice would be easy.
Well, I take both boxes. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah. You're there no matter what. All right. Cool. Listen, what is in the future for Infrequent Flyers, for the Alistair Whiskey, Alistair Walker Whiskey Company? Because that's the official name.
That's the official name, yeah. Really just more of the same. I'll keep on doing what I'm doing. I'm not looking, I don't want to dominate the world. I'm not looking to become some sort of big player in the whiskey industry. I like what I do. It's on a small scale. It keeps me involved. We'll keep re-racking. We'll keep releasing whiskies. I'll keep trying to buy good stock at reasonable prices when I can get a chance to do it. And if I can't do that, I'll just focus on making the stock that I have the best possible stock that it can be. Mm-hmm. And we'll just keep, you know, working away at what we're doing on a very, very small scale, kind of flying under the radar. But yeah, nothing. I'm not going to build a distillery. You know, I'm not buying a distillery. I'm just happy to have my little area to operate
your little
in.
Personal.
Yeah.
Playground.
Yeah. It fits nicely with how I want to be spending the next 10 years of my life, you know.
Two more questions, and then we'll end the podcast. We have a tasting on tonight.
Yes.
What question would you really like somebody to ask? And maybe I'll ask it then.
That's a question. Can I come back? Tell me the next question. I'll have a think
next
about that one.
Is, which question do you really not want somebody to ask?
Well, I certainly
which
would...
question do you hate as being a whiskey guy on a festival and a tasting? Which question do you always hate?
I never like someone to ask me if there's a particular whiskey that I dislike because I don't like to be critical of my contemporaries, and I think almost all whiskies have some form of merit, and I think, you know, you have to be really careful in this industry what you say about other people's products. Mm-hmm. It's a small industry, and I just think you should always be really respectful to what other people are doing. So I never cast aspersions on anyone else's whiskies. Mm-hmm. What was the question that I couldn't answer?
Well, which question would you really like somebody to ask you tonight, or on any tasting?
I would love somebody to ask me tonight if I wanted to buy a cask of 25-year-old Glendronic from them. At a very reasonable price, that would be quite nice.
Okay. Well, anybody that hears this all over the world, if you ever have a cask of 25-year-old Glendronach, just you know who to call.
Absolutely, yeah. That will do. That's the question.
Anything you want to share as your famous last words on this podcast?
No, I just want to say, you know, I'm quite enjoying my week in Belgium. It's the first tasting tour I've done in the Belgian market. The response has been great so far, and just a big shout out to all the people that have bought Infrequent Flyers whiskies in the last 5 years. Every bottle counts, and without people buying the whiskies, there wouldn't be a brand. So yeah, just a big thank you to anyone that likes the whiskey. Appreciate it.
Cool. From my end, I thank you a lot, Alistair, for taking the time to talk to me. I'll like to thank Tastu too for giving us the space to do this before the tasting, and I'm just really looking forward to this tasting that's going to start in about 45 minutes now.
Brilliant. Excellent. Thank you.
Cheers.